Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Nanjis Podcast, an aviation podcast, episode number 16 with Obed Mazzini. Before introducing Obed, just let me tell you something about the podcast. This will be the last episode of the Hong Kong series. We're going to look forward to a new series. I don't know the name right now. For now, today's episode special guest is Obed Mazzini. Obed Mazzini is a Zimbabwean cargo pilot flying the Boeing 747-8 for Cathay Pacific. Before arriving in Hong Kong, he flew for various airlines in Africa. Since his first flight 42 years ago, he flew more than 10 types of aircraft from the first officer position to the base captain position. He's as well the host of the Pilot Obed Instagram account and YouTube channel. I hope you will enjoy this episode, even if there is poor audio quality coming from the recording system I'm using. Anyway, thank you very much for listening to this last episode of the Hong Kong series. Thanks very much for joining me, Obed.
Yes, no problem.
Yeah, so you're currently in Penang?
Yeah, when I live in Penang, I'm here for 2 days, got here yesterday evening.
Oh, lucky, you're flying a lot right now. I guess you have a busy schedule, being a freighter pilot.
Yeah, because, you know, the freighters, even the passenger aircraft, a lot of them, they've removed the seats and they're putting freight on them. So yeah. The freighter business is really busy. Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you have a lot of restrictions, especially, first of all, the hotel restriction in layover. And then as well, you have the quarantine restriction back in Hong Kong. So how do you cope with that? Is it a lot of indoor life?
Yeah, there's a lot of indoor life. You know, the problem is the actual flying is still the same. It's still fantastic once you get on the airplane. It's the process in between getting from flight dispatch to the airplane itself when you're leaving is not difficult. The process is when you get off the airplane now to go home or to go to the hotel. Everywhere there's... Each country seems to have its own thing. If at least all the countries, I think, got together and had one common policy, it would make things much easier. When you get to destination like Penang, for example, in Malaysia, you have to do the usual health screening, temperature check, and then you have to fill out a declaration to say that you're not suffering from any of the symptoms and so on. And then they give you a piece of paper which tells you that you must stay in your location, as in stay in your hotel. It's become a little bit easier in Penang, because in Malaysia at least, because now we just stay in the hotel. We don't have to restrict necessarily to the room, but we have to stay within the hotel, which is better than before, yeah.
Yeah, you don't have any mandatory testings in all the countries?
Not all the countries. We do Hong Kong, we do Dubai, we do... Colombo in Sri Lanka. Yeah, they do mandatory testing. They do the nose thing and all that. And Hong Kong all the time. Even if you go away to a destination where you come back the same day, you come back and still do another test.
Yeah, this is pretty weird. It's kind of a pain to be tested. Even if you don't leave the aircraft, I mean, you don't do the turnaround, you're still tested at the time.
Yeah, if I go to Taipei and come back to Hong Kong, when I come back, I do a test. If I do the same flight the next day, same thing.
You never know if the stick is contaminated with the COVID.
Yeah, so it's a strange thing going on. I've done, I think, I was counting the other day because I keep all the COVID test forms. I've done 14 COVID tests in the last 6 weeks.
Yeah, hopefully it's not a nose COVID test. It's only a spit COVID test for you.
Now it's only spit, which is great. You know, the nose one is uncomfortable. Yeah. The nose one you do in Colombo, that's the nose one.
Oh, Christ. You know? You have to do it only once.
Yeah, it's not painful. You know, it's just uncomfortable, I would say.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable. It's not a kind of usual area of your body that you discover.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Kind of strange. Great. So you're right now in Penang, so you stay for 2 days. Did you do some flights before that, just after leaving Hong Kong, or it's kind of two sectors for you?
Yeah, two sectors. Tomorrow I leave and go to Phnom Penh in Cambodia, and then Phnom Penh to Hong Kong. I do a lot of these flights because I'm an instructor, and as an instructor, I'm involved with training new people who come onto the airplane, because right now they're moving a number of pilots from the 777, which is not doing much work because it's all passenger. So they're moving them to the 747 to at least eventually relieve some of us, because eventually we are going to burn out, we guys on the 747. So they're bringing on some more people just to give us some breathing space and give us some time off when we need some leave and so on. So, which is a good plan that by the company, actually, because we'll be burnt out eventually because we're flying so hard. So we need some help.
Yeah, definitely. I've heard some pilot stories, some 747 pilot stories that told us that they were flying like 95, 100 hours, just something like that. And yeah, it looks like very intense.
Yes, it's quite intense. Can be. I think the main thing that it affects the operation is eventually you start getting long-term fatigue, which can now start manifesting as simple mistakes and silly mistakes in the airplane, in the operation. So the company is aware of that. So that's why they're doing the move of bringing on some extra help from the fleets that are not doing much flying. And it's easy to convert somebody from the 777 onto the 747 because it's a very similar operation.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty strange because in one hand, we have you guys that fly a lot. In the other hand, we have us that don't fly a lot, and both could be safety issues. So it's kind of just hard just to find the balance between those two kind of population.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty weird. So just back up a little bit or a lot for you. So can you tell to the audience where do you come from and how did you get into aviation?
Okay, my origins are Zimbabwe. I was born in Harare in Zimbabwe. And then as a youngster, I was only 3 years old, my father and my mother moved to Zambia, which is where I ended up growing most of my early life. I grew up in Zambia. And I went to school there for the most part, primary, secondary school. And the primary school I went to was a school called Silver Rest Primary School in Lusaka. It's just outside the capital city of Zambia. And this school was just opposite the international airport. So you can understand living at a school which was opposite the international airport at break time and on weekends. It was a boarding school. All I saw was airplanes landing and taking off. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. I got a place at the university in Lusaka in Zambia, but I didn't want to go there. I went there for, I think it was 3 weeks, because it's 3 weeks into the university, I got called for an interview to do a flying course at one of the big training schools that was in Lusaka. So I abandoned university to take my first love, which is what I wanted to do, to fly airplanes. And I went to, it's a flying college in Zambia. It's called ZASTI, Zambia Air Service Training Institute, ZASTI. So I went there, and that's where I did my first flight ever, in a Cessna 150.
How was it? It was back in which year?
That was Cessna 150. That was in 1979.
Oh, great. You knew the good time of aviation. I mean, the complete explosion of the aviation at a time. So how was it, your first flight in the Cessna 150?
It was great. What I wanted to do. You know, the town where I lived, where my parents lived, was it's a small town called Mantha in Zambia. So when they got me in boarding school, it required me to fly from Mantha to Ndola, which is the second city in Zambia, and then from Ndola to Lusaka. And the first ever time I flew ever in an aeroplane going to school was on a DC-3 from Mansa to Ndola and then to Lusaka. And I looked at the DC-3 as I walked up to it to get inside, and I was just awed, and I said, yes, this is what I want to do. From that day on, I wanted to fly airplanes. Little did I know that 25 years later, I would fly the DC-3.
Yeah, really?
And I flew the DC-3. Yeah, I flew the DC-3. Not quite 25 years. I flew it 8 years later or so. I flew the DC-3 from the time I actually started flying as a passenger, and then flying, coming through and getting my flying license, I eventually did fly a DC-3 as a co-pilot with Ethiopian Airlines.
Finally, it was back in which year at the time, around the beginning of the 80s?
Early 1982 to 1983. And then in 1983, by then Zimbabwe, my country had become independent 2 years earlier. And I went back to Zimbabwe and joined Air Zimbabwe. And I was a co-pilot on the Viscount, or Viscount, I think you call it. Yeah. So Viscount, I was a co-pilot on Viscount. I flew the Viscount for nearly 4 years, the 700, 800. Then I flew my first jet, the Boeing 737-200. Yes, the 300 did not exist then. So the Boeing 737-200 was the most advanced at that time. And then from there, I moved on to the 707 as a co-pilot on this Boeing 707. And then very quickly, I went back in 1988 to the BAE-146, which the company had just bought, BAE-146-200, for my command. I became a captain on that, on the 146-200. I think I was 27 at that time, just to almost 27 years old. Yeah,
it's pretty young for a captain.
Yeah, those days for sure. Even now, I suppose.
Yeah, even now. So you stay in Africa, flying the BAE-146, it was Avro, I think?
They call it Avro now, yeah.
Then you stayed in Africa, or did you move to Hong Kong at that moment?
Yeah, then I was in Africa. Basically, I was back in Zimbabwe in 1980, end of 82, early 83, through to 1989. So I flew the 146 command, then I moved to the Boeing 707 command in Zimbabwe as well. And then in 1989, I moved to Hong Kong. My former chief pilot, who used to be in Zimbabwe, had gone to Hong Kong and he was already working for a company in Hong Kong. So he came on holiday to Zimbabwe. And there was a Christmas party. This was in end of 1988.
Yeah.
And he said, he came for the Christmas party at the golf club. So I happened to be there. And he said, hey, you know, we're looking for people on the 707. Would you be interested to come to Hong Kong? I said, of course I'd be interested. He said, okay, good. When I get back in January, I'll send you the application form, fill it in, send it back, and we can do a phone interview. And if you're still interested, we'll sort everything out and you can plan on coming over to Hong Kong. So that's what I did. That's what happened, yeah.
A phone interview at that time.
Yeah. So they sent me the ticket and everything. And in fact, he told me on the phone that I already had the job. So all I had to do was sort out my business in Zimbabwe. And I arrived in Hong Kong and joined Air Hong Kong, which had just got another Boeing 707. So they needed 707 pilots. So my first company in Hong Kong was Air Hong Kong, not Cathay Pacific. So Air Hong Kong. And I went back. I was a captain in Zimbabwe. I came to Hong Kong and I had to be a first officer again for I was the first officer for about 6 months. And then I did the upgrade, but went back into the left seat again. So I was back as a captain in early 1990.
Okay. It was in the, I'm sure it was in the old airport.
Yes, Kai Tak Airport. Great airport. Yeah.
The worldwide known airport for the type of arrival you were flying at the time.
So that was my home base, Kai Tak. And then in 1992, basically, I moved on to the Boeing 747. And I've been on the Boeing 747 pretty much most of that time. Mm-hmm. I became part of the Cathay Pacific family in 1994, when the company basically, Air Hong Kong was bought by Cathay Pacific. And then we all just became Cathay Pacific after that. And I was already a captain on the 747 at that time. So I opted to stay in Air Hong Kong as a captain on the 747. Of course, it became Cathay Pacific because all the 747s were then taken into Cathay Pacific. But I opted to stay on the 747 as a captain rather than going to the main passenger side, which would have made me a first officer again. So I stayed as a captain until my seniority allowed me to be a captain on the passengers. And that's when I became a passenger captain in 2007. I moved back as a passenger on the 747-400.
Yeah. And then because of Cathay Pacific, decided to leave the passenger market flying the 747 and just to remain on the freighter market. It was back in
2016.
And then at that time, you remained on the 747 fleet, but only flying freighters.
Yes, because they grounded all the, they discontinued all the passenger 747s. So yeah, I flew the passenger one from 2007 to 2016. And then I've been on the freighter only now because all the passenger versions have gone.
Yeah. What kind of operation do you prefer? The passenger operation or the freighter operation?
It's a difficult one because there's some aspects of the passenger operation. The passenger operation gives you a certain degree of stability because passenger schedules normally just stay as scheduled because that's the schedule for passenger flying and so on. Whereas freighter schedules can sometimes change quite easily. You can easily have a reschedule and go somewhere else, which if you look at it another way, is actually exciting because on the freighter, we actually have so much variety. You see, for example, on the passenger flight, when I was doing the passenger, I did mostly, my favorite was going to San Francisco and London Heathrow because my children were at school in England, so at boarding school. So I'd do London flights, then go and visit them. Or sometimes I'd do the flights and then fly them back home, or I'd fly them back to school after the holidays from Hong Kong. I'd take the kids back to school, I'd land at Heathrow, and I'd drive them up to school and then come back. And yeah, so that aspect was nice. And also the other aspect, of course, is that you could take your wife with you. In my case, my wife came on several flights with me when I had a longer layover and so on. So that was good and on that side. But the other things you've got to think about on the freighter is that it's very quick. The operation is quick. When the loading is done, you close the doors. You're not waiting for connecting passengers. You're not waiting for a passenger who hasn't turned up at the gate sometimes. And you have to make PA announcements to the passengers to tell them, oh, we have to offload the baggage because the passenger hasn't turned up and so on. I think you've been on an aeroplane as a passenger when that has happened to you.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah. We don't have that issue, you know, on the freighter. But the variety on the 747 freighter right now is excellent. I come here, I go to Singapore, I go to Jakarta. I also do long haul. I go to India, I go to the United States, I go as far as Miami. I can go to Mexico City. So the variety is fantastic. So from a flying point of view, it's great. It's the greatest fleet to be on. And the airplane, of course, is fantastic, both the 400 and the Dash 8.
Yeah, and you can have a second house in Anchorage.
Yes, like absolutely.
Like all the freighters guy.
Yeah, you can have another place in Anchorage, yeah. But Anchorage is a great place.
yeah. Apparently, for the countryside, everything that you can do, like floodplain flights, like if you want to fish, you go fishing. If you want to ski, you go skiing. And yeah, that looks like a very good place.
It is. Yeah. It's. I certainly think I could live in Anchorage. Everybody says, "Oh, wait until the winter," but I've been through a lot of winters in Anchorage, and it's still okay. You know, I can handle it. It's a nice place.
Yeah, and that's. I think it's kind of a strange operation for you because sometimes you take off from Hong Kong with a pretty good weather, then you go to Anchorage, it's minus 20 degrees, icy condition.
Yeah.
And then you take off again from Anchorage to, I don't know, Los Angeles. It's mild weather, like 20 degrees Celsius.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I think, flying-wise and not to build experience because you don't need obviously to build experience, but for the experience, I think it's very nice. The variety of all that flying experience is nice.
Yes, it is. It's that's the thing I say about it is that it's excellent in that sense, and also the certain good aspects of flying freight is when you get to your destination, it takes you. Once you've landed in Anchorage, you're in the United States, you clear customs and everything in Anchorage. So from Anchorage onwards, it's domestic flight, you see. So when you land, at any destination from Anchorage, Miami, Houston, Dallas, it's domestic. It takes 10 minutes to get off the airplane. And within 15 minutes, you're in the transport to the hotel and you're at the hotel in 20 minutes. With 18 cabin crew, passengers getting off, it always took up sometimes 45 minutes, sometimes an hour to get through for all the cabin crew to get on the bus and all that. It's just, and you're so tired sometimes you just want to get out, but you can't because you're waiting for the rest of the crew. So that side I didn't like.
Yeah, especially at 1 o'clock in the morning when you wait at Bangalore, that everybody is getting out of the airplane, the cabin crew is clearing everything, and then you wait and you're just at the hotel at 4 o'clock in the morning. So it's
Yeah, with the freighter, you're out and gone within 15 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. And I was lucky to do those two type of operations, the freighter operation and the passenger operations, because I fly in your sister company. And I have to admit that freighter ops is kind of relaxed because you don't have passengers, you don't have complaining passengers. You just cook your own meal. Yes, you don't have the service, but I mean, it's relaxed.
It's relaxed, yeah. So it's actually much better. We do our own food. It's great. I like it.
Back up a little bit, because I have a question about the African licenses. We don't know a lot about how it works in Africa for the licenses. We know a lot about Europe, a lot about North America and here in Hong Kong. But do you have your own license, or is it kind of international license that you can easily convert to the Hong Kong one?
Yeah, well, the African licenses, you know that every country that's an ICAO member state, International Civil Aviation Organization, they have to follow certain guidelines for the licensing of aircrew. Now, some countries like South Africa, Ethiopia, and even Zambia and so on, have got obviously their own flight training schools. But where I trained, for example, when I did my training and got my PPL first in Zambia, all the exams that we did and so on were the British exams. So the exams would come from the UK, and the theory and everything we did was UK exams, and then they'd send them back to the UK, just as people do international exams for Cambridge or Oxford University in all the schools in the around the world is similar. So the license I got in Zambia and the license I held from Zimbabwe was an international license. When I got to Hong Kong, all I had to do was aviation law.
Yeah.
To learn the differences that I needed to understand for Hong Kong, and I was issued with a Hong Kong license. The license is a good license. It's just because people have no connection maybe with Africa, they think it's a different scene. It's actually the same. The same rules, the same people who train people in Europe, train all the African pilots, and we do the same exams. Everything's the same.
Yeah, it's kind of standardized at the point.
Yes, yeah.
How long have you been flying right now? I think it's more than 40 years.
I started flying, let me see. 90. Well, I started flying first time, first flight was 1978 to now. So how many years is that?
A lot.
42 years.
That's 42 years. Yeah. A very long flying career.
Yeah.
What's next for you? I mean, do you have any age limitation flying here at Hong Kong, or you can fly up to 80 years, 85 years?
No. Well, the rule in most countries is you can fly up to 65. So I've got just nearly 7 years to go. So. Yeah, but I don't need to. My intention is to, I would like actually to give back somehow my aviation experience. So I might be doing some consultancy work or certainly teaching. I like to teach. I've been training people for a long time. So I think I'm going to be in a training group or teaching group somewhere, that sort of thing. Maybe do my intent to do my own thing anyway. Of tutoring and teaching, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you've been teaching a lot, especially in your STC position in your company, in your current company.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for the youngsters?
Yeah, I think what they must understand, these youngsters, is that everything that they're being taught at flight school is very applicable when they get into the airlines. It's applicable in the sense that that knowledge that you gain may be the basic knowledge, and then it will be meshed into what you need to know to apply that knowledge for flying the big jets or heavy turboprops within an airline. And it's not sort of finish college, get your CPL, and then forget about all the books and stuff that you learned at flying college. Keep that information, keep it with you, because quite a lot of it, you'll be surprised, you'll actually refer to it even when you're flying a highly technical 787 or something. There's a lot of stuff that they're teaching you now at college that you should keep and is applicable. So it's quite important to keep that.
Yeah, to keep the knowledge up to date as well, I think. I think you saw a lot of students, not students, but let's say young second officers that you were flying with and that you trained.
Yeah.
That was sometimes a bit of, let's say, not so sharp on the knowledge. And there is nothing more tiring than having a trainee that is not fit, is not sharp on the knowledge. Yeah.
Yes, and because not prepared.
You work for him and you just want him to perform. And if he doesn't have the knowledge, he's not going to perform well.
Yeah. I think, you know, one thing I've noticed, and it's to do with the generation of pilots coming now. When I first started coming across the younger generation now, the millennials, let's call them, and I kept thinking, why is it that these youngsters of today don't seem as keen as we were when I was the same age as them? Because when I was the same age as them, all I thought about was aeroplanes, and that's all I wanted to do was aeroplanes. But I think the modern kids now, for example, we knew about the different types of aeroplanes and the different airlines and so on. I'm not saying the kids of today don't know some of these things, but quite a lot of the ones that I've come across, I can point at an aeroplane at an airport and they won't know what aeroplane it is. You know, they just have no idea, because they've got no idea of the history of aviation, of some of the things that came up. Not all of them. I'm just saying I've come across some of them, and they're in the minority, I've got to say. They're not the majority. The minority, some of them just surprised me that they've just finished their CPL, and they can look at a Galaxy going past at an airport and they don't know that it's a C5 Galaxy. They can look at a DC-8 or something and they don't know it. I mean, these are things which were, for aviators in my time, you just knew every single airplane. That's not important necessarily to fly airplane, but it's just, to me, it shows the degree of keenness and interest. It makes you think that they're in the job because they want to travel and they want to see the world, not necessarily because they want to fly.
The interest is not the same, and this is leading to major issues relating to the motivation.
Yes.
The motivation of the guys. They are more willing to quit.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what it is also with the new generation, maybe us older people don't understand them. And what I can say about them is that I think they are just as passionate about flying as we were. The difference is the generation of today, these kids can multitask and they're not fazed by the fact that they might lose their job and so on. The kids of today, you know, I can speak to my daughter and she says, oh, if I don't do that, then I'll just do this. If this happens to me, then I'll just change and I'll go and do that. Whereas in our generation, if you went into engineering or you went into flying, that's all you wanted to do, and that's all you did. You didn't try and dabble in any other things. The kids of today are trying several things while they're still doing their flying. So it appears, when we look at them, that they're not interested. They're not keen on flying. Actually, they are keen. They're just able to multitask and do several things, maybe because of technology, more than we could. So when we look at them, it seems as if all these kids are just not interested. They don't have the passion. Actually, they do have the passion for flying. They can just multitask more than us older generation. I see it all the time when I come in to Hong Kong and I have to do my COVID test and they're filling in all the forms and so on. When you've got a younger person dealing with all the documents and so on, you're there and you're on your way to go and give your sample within like 3-4 minutes. When you get there and there's an older person, an older generation person, you'll be there for 10 minutes for the same thing. To print out your form and so on. You know, it's just the kids of today have just got the technology in their hands and they know what to do. So because of that, they can do that and they still have the passion to fly, but they can also do other things, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And they have some very good skills, like you said, the multitasking, social media mastering and the communication mastering as well, that is that is linked with the social media.
Yeah.
But I think that, perhaps there is kind of lack in the relationship. The virtual social media thing is not very helping to the relationship that that those guys can have.
Yeah. The other thing I think, if I was to say something negative in a way to the millennials and the Generation Z, if you like, is... I just sense that to some extent, some of them don't value experience. They want things now. They want it now.
Yeah.
So they graduate from flying college. They join an airline. Within a year or so, they want to be captains.
Yeah,
that's the first question they ask when they join. Is only a second officer or a first officer, junior first officer, says, oh, when do you think I'll be a captain? And I'm thinking, well, you know, you really need to work on being an expert at what your position is right now. You know, they want to get to the top, but they don't want to engage in the climb to get to the top.
Yeah, huge lack of patience.
Yes. They want to get there without the work in between. They don't want the work in between. They just want to get to the top. And based on my Instagram, the questions I get... I get lots of kids asking me, I want to be a pilot. What should I do? What can I do? How do I become a pilot? And I think to myself, this is the generation which within seconds can find a particular song, a particular video clip on YouTube, or a particular song on iTunes or whatever. They can do it within seconds. But this is the same generation that can't go online and search for flight training colleges, schools, you know, it's just as easy. They want you to give them that information. They don't want to do it themselves. I'm just talking from my experience on my Instagram, my followers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, questioning is showing that somebody maybe is interesting, unless they're questioning just to try and find out if the instructor knows what he or she is talking about. But I think a lot of the kids today are actually just very keen. They just want to know. I think the ones I meet anyway are asking the question just so that they know, because they've probably developed their own ideas of how something works or how something should be done, and they want you to give them the knowledge as to why it isn't done like that. And if you explain in a certain way that they get it, I find they're very receptive. They just think differently from us, but they're very good. They're good. They pick up and they're good. The ones I'm training are excellent. They're good. You know, they fly well. They have the knowledge, and they're very inquisitive and curious. I've learned to understand that they just think slightly differently to our generation.
Yeah, I agree. They have a good learning curve, and they, due to the multitasking skills, they know how to handle the stuff, especially technical stuff, and with the system stuff as well.
Yeah,
they are good, and I think the learning curve is good as well. Yeah, great. Obed, so you've been flying for 42 years. What's remaining on your aviation bucket list? I know you've done a lot, from the DC-3 to the Boeing 747 being an STC in your company. What's remaining for you now? What do you want to do in aviation?
I think I want to, like I said, I want to leave. It would be a shame for, and it's always a shame for anybody who's very experienced to eventually, when they retire, take that knowledge with them. So somehow I'm going to leave that knowledge. There's a book I'm planning on the line that would be good for students coming up training. And the book that I'm going to write is really to do with the meshing of flight college into airline, that transition period, and what's important. That's the book I'm sort of writing, or I'm starting that soon. And I want to leave that sort of legacy. You've got to leave something behind of everything you gained so that people will use it.
Yeah, and you have to, because 42 years of flying is a lot of experience. Yeah. And I think it's a very high value for everybody.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about your social media? Because I know we talked a little bit about Instagram.
Yeah. I started my Instagram just as a bit of fun, actually. I just said, it'll be a bit of fun. Post some pictures, talk a little bit about airplanes and so on. And then I just found that I started getting a lot of traction and people asking me questions about how certain things work and so on. So I started putting little clips about mainly the Boeing 747 and sometimes just general aviation questions, which I found a lot of people at flight schools, even people that are not in aviation, that are just interested in aviation, started interacting. And it's the interaction that got me more interested in finding out and putting more posts that people wanted to know about. So there's a lot of people that follow me on my Instagram that have got nothing to do with aviation. They're not pilots. They're not connected to aviation in any way. They're lawyers, doctors, and so on, that are just, they just like aviation. And they just want to know how things work. So I've been putting these little clips, and from there, it just grew. People started getting interested and asking me questions. And I started putting, basically responding to a lot of the questions that they were asking. I'd do a little bit of research sometimes and just put it up. But a lot of the things are impromptu. I don't plan it. I just think of something on the moment and do a quick video clip and I post it. So in many ways, a lot of the people like the fact that it's not scripted. I just do it on the spur of the moment and I post it. And people seem to like that, because of all the posts that I put, if I sit down at home and actually edit it and make it all look all nice and so on, people view it, but I don't get as many viewers as something that I just do on the spur of the moment. I'm in the airplane, I talk about this, I talk to my colleagues and post it. That goes viral. Everybody wants to. That's the kind of information where I do something like that and I just do a little bit of information in it as well, plus interactive chatting. And people seem to like that sort of thing.
Obet, thanks a lot for joining me. It's been a real pleasure. And I think your book will be very nice. And I'm just looking forward to reading it.